Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
I thought love was only true in fairy tales. And for someone else, but not for me. Our love was out to get me. That's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. I thought love was more or less a given. I got. What's the use in trying? And all you get is pain. When I needed sunshine, I got rain. Oh, then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer, I couldn't leave her if I tried. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. Yes, I saw her face. Now I'm a believer.
The Monkees. I'm a Believer, the last track from their second studio album, More from the Monkees, released on the 8th of January in 1967 on the Coal Gems and RCA Victor labels. It knocked their debut album from the top of the Billboard 200 chart and stayed at number one for 18 weeks, the longest of any Monkees album, and it also went to number one in the UK.
Monkey Mania.
Yeah.
It reached full swing, I believe, by the time this album. I mean, Monkey Mania, it's a very strange thing. But talking of Monkey Mania, this was written by, you know, the chief monkey himself, Neil Diamond.
Neil Diamond.
Who was a bit of a monkey because he must have made a fortune out of this, ka-ching, because he also had a load of records out that year as well. I mean,
he had worked his ass off, though, in sort of the American Tin Pan Alley, hadn't he, though? He was like, he'd worked for 7-8 years before he really got his songs away and got himself away as an artist.
That's right. I mean, but he's a totally cool guy. But impressively, this was produced by Jeff Barry, who knows one or two things about songwriting himself, because he didn't just produce, but he co-wrote Do Wah Diddy Diddy, Do Ron Ron Ron, He Kiss Me, Be My Baby, Chapel of Love, River Deep, Mountain High.
No.
Yes.
That's
yes.
So. I mean, that's got some kick-ass soul.
So, you know, we've got a guy here who's producing it, who's actually writing.
You can
writing,
feel it, can't you?
Yeah, oh yeah. He's writing all these massive songs and the production, you know. I mean, amazing. Okay.
Sorry, but you start, you know that song. You just can't help it, can you? Sorry,
absolutely.
Darling, carry on.
And also with Phil Spector, Leader of the Pack, he wrote. So, I mean, you know,
no.
Amazing. Yeah. Absolutely incredible. And but, you know, the Monkees were criticised at the time for being a really manufactured band, weren't they?
Well,
you know?
Yeah, they
but
were.
But later on, they really came into their own, because this was sung by Mickey DeLenz, yeah. One of the the Monkees. And
sounds more like a hang.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. But you know, it was a, it, but it was an amazing phenomena. And because I think what they tried to do, the Americans, they tried to do something to counteract the Beatles thing, didn't they?
Yeah.
You know, and they were manufacturing, you know,
Don Kirshner, wasn't it? It was him that kind of fabricated, got the band together, not fabricated, but saw it like, a bit like a Simon Cowell of the 60s, really. You can tell that's that's the kind of thing that he was after. I remember the Monkees, though. I mean, I was born in 66, so I kind of know of that style. And the thing is when you're a kiddie, you know, you don't know, do you? You just think the adults are really boring and smell differently. And you've got like these vibrant young kids who who are doing stuff, and everything feels almost psychedelic, you know, in its colours. You just learn. You're like this sponge of learning, aren't you?
That's right.
For years and years and years. So you can see one, the Monkees, because they were innocent. I remember.
Well, they looked it. You know, I'm sure they weren't. Like, I'm sure there's a lot of sex, drugs and rock and roll going on in the background
somewhere. Well, exactly, but they didn't actually show that. Remember doing the Monkees? We used to do that going home with my mates.
Yeah.
Like after going down the pub. It was, I mean, it was one of those things.
But they didn't even know this record had been released, did they?
No.
Because, you know, it took them by surprise because it was rushed out to capitalise on the band's popularity. And they only learned of the existence of the album while on tour in Cleveland, Ohio.
No.
Yeah, so,
and,
you know.
And in the liner notes, apparently, it cites the songwriters almost above the bill of the actual band members. So, and it was at Nesmith. Yeah, he was really furious because apparently, like, songs about the songs that were selected for the record, they'd recorded 34 and he told Melody Maker magazine that their album, More of the Monkees, was probably the worst album in the history of the world.
You thought the leaden winter would bring you down forever, but you rode upon a steamer to the violence of the sun. Run laughing through your fingers, and you want to take her with you to the hard land of the winter.
Cream, of course, Tales of Brave Ulysses from the second studio album Disraeli Gears, released on the 2nd of November 1967 on the Reaction record label. And of course, we've included this in the show today. Not only was it recorded in 1967, but of course, to celebrate Ginger Baker's life, who passed away this week, a.k.a. Peter Baker.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like he's
Peter Cantankerous Baker.
Oh, yeah, well.
Kick-ass drummer Baker.
I think, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I feel a bit disrespectful now because I never really liked Ginger Baker's drummer. He always sounds like he was all falling down a flight of stairs all the time, all very busy. And I know that the Cream sound really relied upon that sound in his drumming because, you know, he's going mad with the toms and technically, everybody tells me, he was a great drummer. I don't completely see it, but he was right for that man. And, you know, all the stuff that has gone on around him and, you know, how cantankerous he was and sometimes violent and all that stuff, you know, I think it has been a little bit overblown. Later on, obviously, I think he was very sad about the fact he was skint and, you know, he didn't make a lot of money from Cream, really. He made more money out of the revival later on when they did those two shows.
Yeah.
Because originally, of course, because he wasn't really writing the songs, it was principally Jack Bruce, wasn't it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even Clapton wasn't writing an awful lot of it. So, you know, I think he felt very sore about it. And I heard a thing, Mark Riley did a little thing the other night on him. And
it was Six Music, wasn't it?
And it talked a lot about him, but Gervitz, who was in the bass player, who was in the Baker Gervitz army, of course, he said he got on very well with him. You know, I was reading some stuff on Facebook earlier on today, and you know, it's one of those things that I think that the band themselves was such an explosive combination. It was like putting gunpowder together, nitroglycerine, I should say, where you're combining these chemicals and together they become explosive. But this track's unusual because it's only 2:46 seconds long. And we know at this time they were doing jams of like 15, 20 minutes and they'd only do two or three songs, you know, during a performance because they were on with other people at the time. You know, they were on the bill with other artists and they'd probably do two songs, which took them for the half an hour or 40 minutes, you know. Anyway.
Can you imagine, right? So it was engineered by Tom Dowd, the guy that we love completely. He was a complete genius. So you can imagine, like, having Clapton, Bruce and Ginger Baker all in the same room with Dowd.
I mean,
that really would, it's a chemical equation of great magnificence, I think.
Yeah, and Felix Pappalardo was producing it. But they didn't really know what to do with Cream because they were very loud, they were very British, they were very, you know, argumentative and troublesome in the studio.
Yeah.
And Tom Dowd often, you know, he said they thought a fight was going to break out in a second. And of course, sometimes it did.
But there's an energy there, you know, and you know what you say about, you know, I really respect you for the fact that all the time, you say it as you perceive it. You are entitled to your, subjective opinion. It's like I didn't particularly get Ginger's drumming. Got huge respect, like you have.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, you know, does everyone like chocolate? No. Does everyone like ice cream? No. It's okay to, and he wouldn't give two hoots anyway, because music is so subjective. But I was interested in how people were going to talk about him, you know, after he died, in terms of, you know, that kind of eulogy about the way that he's perceived. And he apparently was, he had a reputation, he was rock's first superstar drummer.
Yeah, that's right.
And you see that, you can see, but he had that fusion with, he was melting jazz and African rhythms. And I love the fact that he was into that kind of African rhythm thing. And I wondered whether or not that was something that maybe Tom Dowd had inspired in him, you know, because it was Tom that had worked on Search for Love.
Yeah, with that Native American beat.
Because later on, I mean, after Cream finished and stuff, I mean, he went and set up a studio called ARC, Batacota Studios in Lagos, Nigeria. And that's where Paul McCartney and Wings went to record Band on the Run.
Yeah.
So,
well, Jeff Emmerich in his book, he talks about it, and he was talking about the situation down there, which wasn't particularly healthy from a political and sort of environment point of view.
No,
but anyway,
not so good.
Yeah.
So you've got on the 3rd of May in 2005, that's when Cream reunited and they had the concerts at the Royal Albert Hall in Madison Square Garden. And there's a couple of things just to end this with. There's a quote in Rolling Stone magazine, and Jack Bruce is quoted as saying, "It's a knife-edged thing between me and Ginger. Nowadays, we're happily coexisting in different continents." Like, so Jack Bruce, who died in 2014, lived in Britain, and Ginger at the time lived in South Africa. Although Jack added, "I was thinking of asking him to move a bit. He's still a bit too close." And the other one to finish with is like, there's this, I've been reading some lovely comments, especially with Joel McIver, who's the editor of Bass Guitar Magazine. He was saying that he actually was about to interview him a couple of years ago, and he sat there quietly in the room, and Ginger came in, and he was reading a magazine, chatting to a guy, and it was before the interview, so he didn't say anything to him. Anyway, Ginger left, and then his PA came in and said the interview was cancelled. And that was it. It was over. And he'd done all this research. He was so excited to meet him and do, you know, and have this great interview. And he just said, you know, he really respect him for being a cantankerous kind of chap. And then there's the final story. When you look at these people who've actually encountered him personally, there was this chap saw Ginger Baker sitting in a restaurant or something. And it was just before like an Air Force show or something.
Yeah.
And he went up to him and said, "Hi, Ginger, I just want to," and he just said, "Oh, piss off, I'm waiting for my dinner."
I was born in the desert, came on up from New Orleans. Came upon a tornado, so loud in the sky. I wheel around all day with the moon sticking in my eye.
Captain Beefheart and his magic band. Sure enough, and yes, I do. And that's from their debut studio album, Safe as Milk. And that was released in June 1967 by Buddha Records.
Mm.
Captain Beefheart.
Now,
magic band.
John Lennon had two Safe as Milk promotional stickers on his cupboard doors at home.
Yeah. How cool is that?
Such was the influence of this artist. And again, this is all about 1967. This is another track that was released in this year. We've done up and teen shows. I don't know how many we've done so far. And we've got a few more to go on this very year. But it's such an exciting year for music. Probably one of the greatest years for music that's ever been. Popular music. Anyway, back to Captain.
Well, it's so varied. I was going to say varied, or there's a huge variety.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, the key thing about this is that Ry Cooder, you listen to that beautiful slide guitar at the beginning there, and the groove, he's got such great groove, Ry Cooder. And Ry Cooder was playing the guitar on this record, and he was 20 years old. But it's beautiful. Open tune. But he's really got that black, sudden, beautiful, you know? And when the band kicks in, it's quite aggressive, actually. That bass is quite aggressive and stuff. But it's just a great sounding record. And really, this was, you know, the kicking off point, a lot of people say, for like punk and all those things. Because Beefheart, he was a very troublesome guy, you know.
Yeah.
But when you saw him live, he was, you know, he wasn't like a standard performer he'd be doing.
I was wondering whether or not they were similar to like the Velvet Underground, where they didn't really have a huge commercial success, but they influenced so many people, many musicians. It kind of had that parallel when I was reading about him, because, I mean, I really don't know him that well. I don't know his music. He's a little strange, and I guess I just haven't been in environments where, you know, I'm sat with people who go, hey, have a listen, you know, and put Beefheart on in the background, or just sit and actually actively listen to him.
Yeah.
So, you know.
He's not the sort of musician that you would have listened to before we got together, really,
because, no, that's true, actually.
Yeah, because, you know, you were listening to different things and we were doing different things, but now, you know, we're sort of very steeped in music of all forms.
That's true.
We've really been, you know, doing a lot of research, and these shows, you know, they really do us a lot of good as musicians, don't they? I mean, that's
absolutely
why we love doing them, you know.
And DJ John Peel from the UK was a huge fan from the start for Beefheart, and I love that. I mean, I think the band had more success in Europe than they ever did in the US. And I remember sending John Peel a tape in, actually, from one of my band demos.
Is that right?
Oh yeah, yeah. It was after Megiddo, the folk band. I think I had a band called Trade. I can't remember which band it was now, because, you know, as you do, you change styles
of
and
course,
you progress. Anyway, it was. I rang up the BBC because I wanted to know the address. So I asked to get put through to John Peel's office, and he picked the bloody phone up.
No.
And I said, John, is that you? He went, yeah, it is. And I went, and I was working in radio at the time, so I was doing a nighttime radio show. And I'd heard that the night before they gave him a surprise honour, like an award. And I said, I heard you on the way down to work last night. I said, you sounded so like surprised. He went, yeah, it was really lovely, you know. And of course, I said, oh, I was just wondering where to send a tape to. And he gave me the address, and I put the phone out. I went, anyway, lovely to speak to you. Put the phone down, and I thought, I'm really bad at marketing, you know. I forgot to tell him my name or the name of the band.
No.
How can I be sure, in a world that's constantly changing, how can I be sure where I stand with you? Touch me, but don't take me down. Whenever I'm away from you, my alibi is telling people I don't care for you. Maybe I'm just hanging around with my head upside down. It's a pity I can't seem to find someone who's as pretty and lovely as you. How can I be sure? I really, really, really want to know. I really, really, really want to know. Oh,
changing. How can I be sure I'll be sure with you?
The Young Rascals. How can I be sure from their third album, Groovin'? That's a terrible name for
I know.
Released on the 31st of July, 1967 on Atlantic Records.
Jerry Wexler.
So this, it was the same label as Cream.
I know.
Unbelievable. And later on Led Zeppelin. You know, I mean, incredible. And a load of, you know, people in the past, like the soul people.
Aretha.
Atlantic were all over the place in those days. Great. And what a fantastic song. My favourite version, of course, is the one done by Dusty Springfield, which is, you know, she's just fantastic, isn't she?
Yeah.
But this is the original and a great, great song. Written by Felix Cavalier and Eddie Brigatti.
Well done.
Yeah, they sound like a couple of furniture manufacturers, don't they? They look like they're going to knock up a couple of settees. But anyway.
I was thinking about musketeers, you know.
Whipping out the sabres.
Yeah, yeah, the cavaliers. Cavalier.
Yeah, and but, you know, the songwriting in these times in the 60s was absolutely sensational. You know, the beautiful choruses, the beautiful laying back into the verse, you know, the arrangements, just great. And Cavalier said that the only reason why they were brave enough to write this song is because the Beatles did Michelle and Yesterday.
It's weird that, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, and you can kind of hear it because it has got a lilt to it. And the Beatles were so massively influential, you know, at this point, you know, they've been building up to Sgt. Pepper, which was released this year.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it was marvellous, marvellous.
Well, he knew the Beatles as well because he toured Europe with them in 63 when he was a member of Joey D and the Starlighters.
No. Yes, it is. Johnny D and the Starlighters.
Yeah. And then he was in the Rascals and they actually opened.
Did you say Wascals then?
No.
I think you did.
I did not.
Willie Swadwick.
Wadwick.
I think you said Wascals. No, anyway.
Behave, be nice.
Okay.
And anyway, so the Young Wascals, they opened for the Beatles at their Shea Stadium concert on the 15th of August of 65. So when you're hanging out with these guys, I mean, there is... I don't think people hang out the same these days. Maybe they do. I don't know. It just doesn't feel the same. But then again, how would I know? But I love it because it was a lot more organic, you know, and you knew things, you know, or they weren't keyboard warriors at that time. You had to physically go out and meet people. And I really, really wish that people would just put their phones away and flush them down the toilet, you know, and just go out and meet people, because that's when you really get to understand and learn. You know, we need to learn from each other as people, not, you know, 15% of communication is with the words, 85% is with the whole body and everything. We don't know each other because we don't meet in person, because we're always like looking at each other, you know, on a screen. At least with radio, which I love, you can hear in the voice, you know.
Well, tomorrow, of course, we're going to go and see our, well, friend. We have not met her yet.
But no,
Els
we
Bailey
haven't.
In Hamburg, so that's going to be very exciting. We like to go and see other artists.
Well, the weird thing
that
is that
contemporaries.
We met Els because when we had the studio based in Valencia in Spain, we did this live broadcast.
We did.
And it was a satellite link up with the UK to Spain.
Yeah.
And so we were doing a couple from the Convent in Stroud when it was open. And so we did a couple of songs, and Els was in the UK at the Convent wearing a beanie hat. I remember, and she sang a song, and then it was like over to us in Spain, and we sang a couple of songs, then went back to Els. And that's how we've never met in person.
So tomorrow night.
I know.
Is the night.
There must be some way out of here. Say the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine. Plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. Thank you. The thief he kindly spoke. There are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now, the hour is getting late. All along the watchtower, princes kept the view, while all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching, the wind began to howl.
Bob Dylan, All Along the Watchtower, from his eighth studio album, John Wesley Harding. Released on the 27th of December in 1967 by Columbia Records. And the album marked Dylan's return to semi-acoustic instrumentation and folk-influenced songwriting after three albums of lyrically abstract, blues-indebted rock music. Quote.
Yeah, well, he still can't tune his guitar. Because at the beginning there, yeah, you know, it's definitely out of tune.
What about his nose?
Well, he can't tune his guitar, really. It's slightly out. His voice is awful, you know, but it's Bob Dylan.
That's true.
And the thing is with Bob Dylan, if you listen to him, just if he rocked up somewhere, you think, God, he can't sing, that guy. But we've got used to the fact he can't sing. It's like listening to Neil Young. Neil Young has a very unusual whiny voice, but it sounds fantastic.
Marmite, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, and that thing. You know, he can't play harmonica either, but he can write songs.
That's true.
Absolutely no doubt about that.
He's kick-ass songwriter.
And this became, of course, massively famous the year after with when Jimi Hendrix recorded it. And it was recorded, the tape op was our big friend Phil Brown on that session, and apparently was done after them being at a club one night, and they came back to the studio, and Phil got a call, so we need to get into the studio now, Hendrix wants to record, and he did this. And he did the whole thing in one evening. Like very quick, all the overdubs, everything amazing.
What is it with Bob Dylan songs though? Because it feels like there's so many people that cover them that I think it's probably their simplicity that they connect, don't they? So you feel like you can actually sing them yourself. You could pick up a guitar and you could sing them. They're quite simple in terms of the structure.
Mm.
I mean, this one just goes on and on in terms of its verse repetition. But
yeah.
But I think that's what it is. And I think when you first, I remember picking up a Beatles songbook, and, you know, what you want to do is just, you want to be able to just feel that you can do it. You can play a couple of chords and you can sing a song from the beginning.
And yeah.
Otherwise, if it gets too complex, you give up real quick, or you just don't feel you can do it to start with, you know?
Well, I think a lot of people as well, what they did with the melodies is that they actually extended them a little bit, because Bob Dylan, it's rather like Leonard Cohen. You listen to Leonard Cohen doing Suzanne. There's not a lot of variation. It suggests...
the river.
Yeah, it suggests the melody. But it doesn't actually complete the melody. And then when you listen to someone like Jeff Buckley do, you know, Hallelujah, it's a soaring masterpiece.
Mm.
And like we're here with Hendrix, you know, it's a soaring masterpiece, because also he added all the instrumentation and the guitar, which is fantastic, a big reverb guitar and all those beautiful parts. And his voice, which was, you know, Jimi Hendrix's voice was great, you know.
Do you know what's really lovely as well, as I think that I've always thought that it's with songs, you can imagine a harmony.
Mm.
And I think there's space in these songs where you can take part, you can join in, you can either sing along or you can do a harmony if it comes to you in that kind of natural sort of organic way.
Yeah.
But I know that Bob went down to Nashville in the autumn of 67 just on a kind of a whim, and he just put down a few songs for the album, and he found a couple of musicians in Nashville, and I think the whole album took less than like 12 hours to do, because when he gets on it, he just gets on it.
Yeah, well, he wrote the songs, but I've got to say that the playing's a bit suspect all round, really. But anyway, there we are. It wouldn't happen in Nashville now, of course. The Nashville machine would make it perfect, which, of course, would be terrible. Traffic, of course. Paper Sun released as their debut single on May 1967 on Iron Records. It was a number 5 hit in the UK, number 4 in Canada, and peaked at number 70 on the Cashbox Top 100 charts in the United States. Steve Winwood again. He's all over 1967.
He is. That's why I wanted to program another Traffic in, because it was their debut single, and this was the sound of flower power, really, for the UK. They were at the forefront of psychedelia.
Really interesting, you know, Melody and you know, Winwood and Capaldi, brilliant, just brilliant work. And this was engineered again by our friend Phil Brown.
Phil!
You know, at Olympic Studios, our favourite, you know, studio in the whole world, sadly no more. Although you took a picture of me outside it, it's never filmed.
You looked like you were in Willy Wonka's sweet shop.
Oh, I was,
if you were into chocolate, that's how you looked.
I was
really
super excited. We were on our way down to the Half Moon in Putney, wasn't
that's right,
we?
That's right, we were playing the gig that night. Yeah.
And it was produced by the lovely Jimmy Miller, a great producer again, who used to get involved in a lot of the sessions. But just brilliant. I loved it. And there is something about a haunted house that was used to write. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, you know, when they formed the band, they decided to go and do like a writing retreat. Mm. So they hired this this kind of cottage in Aston Tyrold in Berkshire.
Blimey.
In the UK, that is. I know it's a bit of a mouthful, Aston Tyrold. And to write and rehearse new material. And it became sort of like legendary as well. So yes, it was reportedly haunted, but people used to pop by, all their mates like Clapton, Pete Townsend, Eric Burdon, Trevor Burton of The Move. So I love those stories because, you know, you're out there writing and these guys go, oh, let's just pop down the road, you know, because
yeah,
Stevie
As we were saying before, it's this interaction. But the great thing about it, and this no longer happens to this extent, I just know it doesn't, you know, they were given full financial backing by Island Records boss Chris Blackwell, who intended to promote the band to help them launch an Island Records as a major act label, which, of course, it did. It really broke Island.
Indeed.
You know?
Yeah, because, I mean, Stevie Winwood was just already prolific at the time anyway. So I think he really trusted Stevie and people knew him as well. But the one thing, there's a bit of trivia. Have you noticed there were secret notes here question marks?
Go
okay.
On.
So they formed Traffic, yeah? And there was already, apparently, an obscure band in South London at the time called Traffic Jam.
Ah, of course.
So the guys in Traffic Jam decided that they better rename the band. So guess what they renamed their band to?
Go on.
Status Quo.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. I can see it in your eyes that you despise the same old lies you heard the night before. And though it's just a line to you, for me it's true and never seemed so right before. I practice every day to find some clever lines to say to make the meaning come through. But then I think I'll wait until the evening gets late and I'm alone with you. The time is right, your perfume fills my head, the stars get red and oh, the night's so blue. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. Time is right, your perfume fills my head, the stars get red and oh, the night's so blue. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you.
Frank and his daughter Nancy Sinatra and Something Stupid. And that was released as a single in March 1967 on the Reprise record label. It was a major worldwide hit. It was number one in Austria, Canada, Ireland, Australia, Norway, South Africa and the UK. It also spent 4 weeks at the top of the Billboard Hot 100 charts and a mighty 9 weeks at number one in the Easy Listening charts, which is nowadays, I think, called the Adult Contemporary charts.
Written by Carson Parks, who probably on the strength of it bought a whole fleet of limousines. It was a folk boats. Singer from LA. But it's, you know, people, the emails are cases saying that they criticise our song choice because they say, you know, this is like a rock, supposed to be a rock and that. But it's not. It's about music. It's about great songwriting and great performances. And this is a great performance. It's a magnificent song and played by the Wrecking Crew.
Exactly.
Hal Blaine, the mighty late great Hal Blaine on drums. Roy Catton on trumpet. Victor Feldman on percussion. Bob Miller piano. Oliver Mitchell trumpet, Donald Owens piano, Glenn Campbell on guitar,
Carol Kay on electric bass,
Ralph Pina on string bass,
exactly.
In tune.
Indeed, I heard it.
Because a lot of
it.
These weren't in tune, but he was in tune, of course he was. It's Ralph. My God, fantastic track. You know? And it was nominated for Record of the Year in the 10th Grammy Awards, losing to the Fifth Dimension hit song, Up, Up and Away, which was played a couple of weeks ago.
Up and Away.
And that's a great song. But can you imagine this losing to something as a Grammy? Wow, what a song. Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, Jimmy Mack, released as a single on the 3rd of February 1967 on the Motown's Gaudy label. It peaked at number 10 in the Billboard 100 charts and went to number 1 in the Billboard R&B singles charts, number 21 in the UK. Great song written by the creative team, Brian Eddie Holland and Lamont Dozier, and the band were called the Funk Brothers. Now, what a funk Great name. Who would not want to know that fuck Motorcycle Rats?
We know them, don't we?
Yeah, fantastic.
It's like, they're great. Well, this song, and the reason why I really wanted to put this song in this whole series is that for 40 years on, it remains one of the label's defining releases and it really helped create the sound of 60s America.
Mm.
But the story goes that it was actually recorded and written like a couple of years before, put on the shelf because they thought it sounded too much like a Supreme song. And then Berry Gordy heard it again. He said, get this thing ready to go out right away. This is a damn hit record. But also because of the sign of the times in 67, by that time, the Vietnam War had become a highly debated issue among the American public. So the sentiments of Martha, you know, saying Jimmy Mac, come back, it took on a different meaning, particularly to those who were stationed overseas.
It was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Papa said to Mama as he passed around the black-eyed peas, well, Billy Joe never had a liquor since. Pass the biscuits, please. There's 5 more acres in the lower 40 I got to plow. And Mama said it was a shame about Billy Joe anyhow. Seems like nothing ever comes to no good up on Choctaw Ridge. And now Billy Joe McAllister's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Brother said he recollected when he and Tom and Billy Joe put a frog down my back at the Carroll County Picture Show. And wasn't I talking to him after church last Sunday night? I'll have another piece of apple pie. You know it don't seem right. I saw him at the sawmill yesterday on Choctaw Ridge. And now you tell me Billy Joe's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Mama said to me, child, what's happened to your appetite? Well, I've been cooking all morning and you haven't touched a single bite. That nice young preacher, Brother Taylor, dropped by today. Said he'd be pleased to have dinner on Sunday. Oh, by the way, he said he saw a girl that looked a lot like you up on Choctaw Ridge. And she and Billy Joe was throwing something off the Tallahatchie Bridge. A year has come and gone since we heard the news about Billy Joe. Brother married Becky Thompson, they bought a store in Tupelo. There was a virus going round, Papa caught it and he died last spring. And now Mama doesn't seem to want to do much of anything. And me, I spend a lot of time picking flowers up on Choctaw Ridge and drop them into the muddy water off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
Thank you. Bobby Gentry, Ode to Billy Joe, and that was released as a single on the 10th of July, 2 days after my birthday. In 1967, I would have been one on Capitol Records, and within 3 weeks of its release, it was number one for 4 weeks in the US and became a massive international seller. It kept up Diana Ross and the Supremes from the number one spot because it had a song out called Reflections, and that would have been their 11th single. I didn't hit it. And it was nominated, this is the thing, for 8 Grammy Awards, wow. And she won 2 for Best New Artist, Best Female Pop Vocal Performance, and her arranger, Jimmy Haskell, won a Grammy as well. She was from... Now, I just want to quickly say, because I know we're coming to the end of the show, right? Mm. She was from Chickasaw County in Mississippi. Now, who is Bobby Gentry? Because she's somebody that hasn't really naturally translated or into my world. Mm. And I was quite enamoured and intrigued by this lady. I love the song to start with, and it's only when you start to look into what the substance of her life and her music is all about. You sit back and go, well, I missed that one. That's like missing Concorde flying over your house. It really is. Seriously, it really is. And there's a beautiful story because both her parents divorced shortly after she was born. So her mother moved to California, and she was actually raised by her paternal grandparents on their farm in Chickasaw. Mm. And her grandmother traded one of the family's milk cows for a neighbor's piano when she was 7.
Wow.
And so she composed her first song called My Dog Sergeant Is a Good Dog. When she was 7. Fantastic. Isn't that lovely? I mean, that's real story. It's just like, you know, when I grew up, my parents had already got rid of my grandparents' piano, you know. So I used to play everybody else's piano when I went to their house. And I loved the fact they traded in a milk cow for their neighbour's piano. Well, so beautiful.
Yeah, Bob Hope was also a big supporter of hers when she performed at a nightclub in Las Vegas, apparently.
Yeah.
So there.
So anyway, I want to listen more to Bobby Gentry because I think she was quite a kick-ass woman at that point in time. But, darling, it's the end of the show.
I'm afraid it is, but we're going to play out with the marvellous Staples Singers. Mavis Staples, singer, you know, singing this way, fantastic family affair, you know, completely. And by the mid-60s, the Staples Singers, inspired by Pop's close friendship with Martin Luther King Jr., became the spiritual and musical voices of the civil rights movement, I should say. So this is For What It's Worth, written by Stephen Stills. See you next week. Everybody look what's going on.